Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Eric Hernandez. Eric is a senior vice president and principal with Lee & Associates in Ontario. During Eric's career, he has worked individually and with a team of brokers within Lee & Associates, where the team achieved regional and national recognition within Lee & Associates and real estate community for the team's success. Eric has been involved in over $1 billion worth of commercial real estate transactions during his career and specialized in industrial real estate. Eric, thanks for joining us again.
Glad to be back.
We had just touched on the subject of robotics and off-air, we had just briefly talked about, I had watched Amazon, they had a tape on how they pick parts, and they had these robots come in underneath the shelf, pick the shelf up, deliver the entire shelf of merchandise to the guy that was going to pick that particular part off the shelf, and then the shelf returned, and then you realize that 1,000 of these robots were doing it at the same time, passing each other by an inch and never touching each other, and it was fascinating for two reasons. One, I can now translate that to someday I'm going to be next to an automobile who has that kind of accuracy, and I'm going to be okay when I'm driving next to him. But I also thought how many people didn't get employed because that robot's doing its thing. So you have these massive buildings, is technology getting so advanced that what you thought would happen to the employment inside of a building that big is not even coming close to that number?
That is true in some respects. Now, one of the big pushes, you probably know who John Husing is.
Yeah, sure. And I just interviewed him a month ago, something like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. One of the things that, and he and others, he's not the only one, but it really spoken to, which we've seen developing for a while too, is that with the automation in these big warehouses especially, you may see lower numbers of employees than you might have historically seen, say, 20 years ago because of the automation component. But these systems are very high tech, and so the knowledge and the brain power and the skill, right? It's the learned skill necessary to operate, you know, the machinery, the equipment, the computer systems, demands a more trained professional in the building. And because of that, they typically have the ability to pay more.
Right.
And so although the number of employees may be down, you know, the average, wage is up because of the additional requirements of the workers, the employees that company will need in the facility. And so, there are a lot of campuses now and organizations that are really working on, you know, additional worker training. And a lot of these companies will even send their employees to develop additional skills because they need that to run their equipment.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, because this is sort of, at least for my world, this is a new category. I'm sure I'm behind the curve because it's not what I do, but you know, just watching some of these videos, 3D printers building homes, things like that, you're going, what? it's mind-boggling what's next, I guess.
The insides of some of the warehouses that I've, that's the part I like about what I do, is I get to see how, you know, so many companies implement what they do so many different ways. We were talking about Amazon and their use of technology, and yet, if you look at the footprint of Amazon's warehouses, one thing that they do, or they've often done, is they will have a much larger parking lot for employees so that they can flex during their busy season and hire more employees. And so on the one hand, here's a company that is getting heavily into automation and robotics, and I believe they bought a robotics company whose technology they were using. They liked it so much they wanted it for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when they're busy, they'll be hiring, you know, thousands of employees to work in their warehouses during their peak season. So although the technology component is definitely there, you know, a lot of these companies, you still need people, you know, to work in these buildings and run these businesses for sure.
you know, the looking at the employment chart for California, it's improved. There's been a lot of talk about it's improved, but it's not the jobs that were before. Certainly the construction job for residential hasn't come back. What part does the unemployment or the employment situation play in the industrial or office spaces?
So there are a few things happening in the employment world. You know, some of the people that I work closely with are a lot of these staffing companies, for example. You know, a lot of these warehouses use temps.
Okay.
Temporary workers, because they it's easier for them to handle, you know, dealing with the employment agency and outsourcing some of those things rather than trying to handle it all in-house, because the employment agencies, the staffing agencies, will do a lot of the interviewing, screening, things like that in advance. And it's becoming harder and harder to place people and to find quality employees because the unemployment rate has gotten so low. And I think what's going to happen, based on what I'm being told and what I hear, is that some of these or a lot of these companies are going to be quite surprised when they're not able to pay the employees what they thought they could pay them. And I think that we're going to see a pretty decent spike in the average wage in a lot of these buildings, because they're going to have to pay these people more to work in the buildings. I think that's coming.
Well, then that could translate. That's like the missing piece of inflation. That's one piece we haven't had, is anything to do with wages going up.
The people that I talk to on the staffing side and on the executive recruiting side are all telling me the same thing, that it's getting harder and harder to find quality employees to place. And, you know, recruiters are a great example, right? They get paid when they place people. And when they're having problems placing people, you know, they feel it. So I think if you're you know, an employee looking to move around or something, now's a great time to be shopping around for something if you're not happy in what you're doing, right? I mean, you know, hopefully in life we can all find something that we love to do and you're happy doing it. And, you know, I think that, you know, from what I've heard, that those wages are all going to get pushed up across the board.
That makes perfect sense. And then the push to get the minimum wage to be a lot higher would have to probably translate into that same thing.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out, right? Because some cities are trying to do that on an individual basis, and you know, I don't know how that'll all work out, because if it's a city that's doing it, you know, that company can always move across the street, right?
That's true.
If they really want to dodge it, but there is just a natural supply and demand thing that is going to happen if things continue, where you know, companies are going to have to pay more to keep quality employees.
What we've talked about in the industrial, if we're going to grade a chunk of commercial real estate, if we gave industrial an A, what would we give office?
You know, office is not my primary specialty, so I'll just put an asterisk next to whatever grade I put out there. And there are a handful of quality office people out there, including in our office, that if you'd ever want to talk to, I could set you up with, that are far more knowledgeable than me. But based on, you know, talking to them and what I know, it's probably, you know, before the last couple of years, it was probably a C, and now you're approaching a B. And it'll be interesting to see some of these big office buildings that had been on the drawing board for quite some time. It'll be interesting to see what gets built over the next few years. You know, there's some projects you might be familiar with in downtown Riverside, I think, that have picked up some steam, that, you know, in terms of redevelopment and things getting built, that, you know, it's nice to see, you know.
Well, the space that we bought 4 years ago sold for $950. We bought it for $319. Don't really know what the valuation is, but I know that park literally has been 70% vacant for the entire time. Until just recently, I would say within the last year, there's been occupants probably for 30% of it. So That's been a pretty long journey. I mean, you've had to have some pretty deep pockets to say, okay, well, we'll just wait 4 years until we get a tenant.
They must have deep pockets.
They do. I'm sure they do. But it must be that the demand just wasn't there for that space. So I guess a natural question would be, the way this comeback has happened, is this the typical comeback where industrial real estate precedes office?
Industrial definitely preceded office, for sure. And the last two cycles that I've been through, I've seen that both times, where office seems like, you know, office is interesting because it can sometimes be the last to come back. And it's also a far different equation. You know, some of these users can really function in an improved office build or an improved industrial building. You know, we joke that an office building is really just an improved industrial building.
Okay.
Right, because it's drop-ceiling air-conditioned. And the interesting thing that I'm hearing from people in the office world is that the users today are looking to fit more people into less space. And so a rule of thumb for office buildings in the past had been that if you were going to build a building, you would typically want what's called a 4-to-1 parking ratio, meaning that for every 1,000 square feet of office, you'd want 4 parking stalls, meaning that each employee was going to take up about 250 square feet.
Okay.
Today, you see some of these companies going to open floor plans and drop stations or touchdown stations where employees might not even have an assigned desk. You know, they have a laptop and all their files are electronic and they can just sit wherever they want to. And they may sit in one place one day and the next day they're sitting somewhere else in the office. And so that type of layout at a 4-to-1 parking ratio, that's not enough.
Right.
Those types of uses are really going to be 5 or maybe even 6-to-1. And with most office buildings, you know, if they're built out at max coverage when they're built, it's very difficult to add additional parking when you're already out of parking.
Correct.
And so newer buildings today, I think you'll see, will definitely be built, or at least ought to be built, with higher parking ratios in mind, because they're going to be looking to put more employees in the same size of building.
Huh, that's an interesting twist. It's almost like what you're talking about with the industrial, having the height of the ceiling or the, you know, the fire alarm. It's more appropriate for today's user, and you're saying that the existing office space really can't adjust to that. So the new office space would be wise to say, okay, we're going to build something that doesn't exist now, and it'll have an attraction.
That's right. That's right. And if you're going to build it, you want to make sure that you don't build something that's obsolete the day that, you know, you're having your grand opening.
Any impact from foreign money? It's been there's pockets where they are definitely an impact for residential real estate. The Chinese market has, you know, the stock market exploded, the price on real estate exploded. A lot of that money found its way to here, but I got to assume that some of that money has found its way to commercial real estate.
What we might refer to as the Chinese market, you know, during the peak in the last cycle, especially if you were into Chino or into the City of Industry, for listeners that don't realize, you know, the Chinese market heavily influences, you know, the ebb and flow of the market. And that market typically had a preference for buying new buildings. And so, you know, they were definitely, a very important part of our market and are today. And, you know, some very large companies out here today are part of that segment of the market today. And I think that will continue. And now it's maybe a little bit more of an organic growth combined with additional money coming overseas. You know, some of that money were EB-5, you know, the foreign visas.
Yep.
Where people pulled money. And I've heard some reports of maybe that getting clamped down a little bit because it was being taken advantage of. And there have been a couple of schemes exposed where people were getting taken advantage of. And, you know, gosh, people getting greedy, that never happens, right?
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But the general demand itself, you know, I've typically always got, you know, somebody at one of my clients that is making a trip back and forth from China. And it's not uncommon, you know, to plan my weekly agenda around, you know, someone maybe on the way to China or on the way back from China.
Mm-hmm. Is this market likely to get as impacted by spec buyers as the boom the last time? Or did they, maybe I should ask, did they impact the market last time? People that just said, I think I'll buy one of these because it's going to go up.
You know, the spec buyers the last time around, we often saw in what I would call small to medium-sized buildings, 5 to 50,000 square feet. And there are a couple of, you know, long-time developers in the market out here that we've had some laughs with, but painful laughs, okay, because, you know, this developer would buy the land, put his name on the line for a construction loan, build a project, go to the city, take 2 years to get it approved, right?
Right.
Take the risk to build, and then make a couple of pre-sales while he's under construction. He's thrilled, right?
Right.
Takes, you know, call it 9 months to finish the project, and at the point in time that the project's completing, that buyer, his first pre-sale, might have put his building back on the market and then sold it or flipped it,
mm-hmm.
and made more money than the developer did that took 3 years to get that building to get built.
Exactly. I like that second guy. I like him.
So, you know, like anything, that works until it doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, we haven't seen a lot of that this time around. You know, most of the bulk industrial investors have been driven by, you know, pension funds, institutional money, teacher retirement systems. You know, there were some, you know, active buyers out of area. We saw some Australian companies come in that have been very active, that have both bought and sold off assets in the last few years, and made some strategic partnerships that have become very active here in the U.S. And, I think that will continue to happen. You know, the U.S. is one of the safest places in the world to invest in hard assets. You know that your money and your assets are going to be protected. I mean, that's what makes this country great.
There we
really
have
is.
That we have rules in place, and you might have some ebbs and flows, but you know you own something.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Usually, when you have a market that's feeling as confident as the industrial market is, it usually translates to people who lend to that. So how has that journey been from, you know, like the peak last time where maybe lending was pretty easy to it was very hard to what is it like now?
The lending community is very active and very aggressive in pursuing deals. So, you know, the quality of the borrower is always a factor no matter what kind of market you're in. I have seen the loan to value ratios start to creep up, start to increase a little bit. Yeah. They were very conservative for a while.
And what is it now and what was it?
Oh, you know, at the bottom it was probably 60 to 65%. But loan to value ratios are tricky because they're loan to value ratios based on appraised value.
Right. Yeah.
So if you've got an appraised value that comes in and it's low, then, I mean, you really might be talking 50 to 55% LTV, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of appraisers that, although they should always be independent, you know, there's an ebb and a flow in the market, and appraisers, I think, have done a pretty good job in that. But I think there was some pressure behind the scenes to not...
not be aggressive, for sure.
Not be aggressive, yeah. Yeah, because
well,
of what happened.
I don't know if they have the same process for commercial, but I know the easiest way to lose an account as an appraiser is to have a review appraiser change your number. So, you know, when the first appraiser's got that in the back of his mind, he's not going to be aggressive because thinks it might go past a review desk, and all of a sudden he's like doesn't have the jobs anymore.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a tightrope that most of the appraisers out here that I know, I think, do a great job of handling. I mean, there really are some great appraisers out here, especially on the commercial side. But, you know, those ratios on the LTVs now are back up in the 70-75% range. And you can get, you know, in our market, the SBA has relaxed some rules in the last few years.
Okay.
And for listeners that aren't familiar, you can typically buy a piece of industrial commercial real estate with 10% down, and the other 90% will be financed.
If you occupy it.
If you occupy it, you've got to occupy 51% of that property, and you know, which for some people is nice because they could occupy, you know, a little over half of it, and they could rent out the rest of it either as an investment for them or with future expansion in mind. Maybe they might need that in a few years, but the cost to move, especially if you're a manufacturer, can be very expensive.
Yeah.
And so they could have that, you know, and give them the flexibility for future growth if they need it, but not be tied to it and be able to rent it out in the meantime and generate additional cash flow. And so the SBA relaxed a few rules. They increased the loan amounts that they would approve, and they relaxed and actually eliminated a couple of net worth restrictions on individual borrowers. And so, you know, that's been always been a very good component of financing for the market out here. And I, frankly, it's just gotten better in the last few years.
Is that by and large a fixed or a variable product?
Typically fixed. You know, a lot of people will say, oh, the SBA rate is X, and they'll quote it. What actually happens is there's two types of products, the 7A and then the 504. 7A typically would float, but in the last couple of years, they've actually started to fix some of those rates. The SBA 504 is typically in two components. So we talked about if you put 10% down, you know, the other 90% gets financed.
Right.
Of that 90%, 50% would be in the form of a first trust deed by a name brand bank.
Okay.
And that would typically be fixed for 20 years.
Okay.
Or 25 years.
Amortized in that time length as well?
So during that time, it would be typically fixed for 10 years.
Okay.
But amortized over 25, so it would be due in 10.
Okay, 25 due in 10.
That's right.
All right.
And sometimes they might have a float where it would adjust after 5 years. So it, you know, some banks will fix it the whole time. A lot of them would have an adjustment after 5 years. So you just, you know, it depends on the bank and the terms. But the real benefit of that SBA is the second. So the other, you know, the last 40% of the capital structure, and those would be fixed, fully amortized over 20 years.
Okay.
With no reset or, you know, and when rates are as low as they've been, you know, that's something pretty nice to be able to lock in.
What is the, we've only got about a minute and a half. What is the cap rate, expectation at this point? Where are we at?
Well, for big industrial buildings, you know, the cap rates have started to hover around 4%. And long story short, when cap rates get that low, it's a demonstration of two things, I think. It's really buyer demand, but what it really is telling you is there's an expectation for rental growth. Because the cap rate is just looking at the current income, but there's an expectation that that income is going to grow, maybe dramatically over the next few years.
Right. Okay, that makes perfect sense. Is mezzanine financing alive and well?
Mezzanine financing is starting to come back. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and just in the last year or two.
And that's more expensive financing that hovers in what, second position?
Second position, right.
What is the rate and term for that usually?
Well, it depends. They'll typically be looking for a preferred return, you know, somewhere in the 8 to 12% range. Some of those have come down depending on their desire to make deals.
Okay. So it's almost a hard money loan.
It's the lubricant that helps make deals happen sometimes.
Yeah.
You might be familiar with that.
Yes. I don't know that I'd want to be holding the bag when it changed, but I guess that would take a very knowledgeable person in the commercial world to pull that off. Eric, we've run out of time. Do you have a website that you'd like to steer people to?
For now, I would just say leanassociates.com.
Okay. Eric, thank you so much for joining us. It's really been enlightening. It really has.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Bruce.
All right, Eric. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.